One, two, three, Natalie!
Hi, welcome to the Person Natalie podcast. I'm your host, Natalie. Today's special guest is Wookie Kim. Wookie is a lawyer who resides in DC. And between his jobs this summer, he set on a 45-day road trip around the country through 33 states. His goal was to run as many national parks as possible along the way. And so today on the show, we're going to be talking about his epic trip. So Wookie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, excited to have you here. So for this road trip, what made you decide to do this trip? You had a couple months off and you decided that you wanted to like just travel around the States.
I'm someone who's really loved traveling and knew that I wanted to spend at least a significant chunk of that time traveling. And so then it became a decision about where to go. And I knew that I had seen a lot of this country, but not enough of it. I kind of set out to visit all of the states that I hadn't been to yet.
Yeah.
With the exception of Alaska, because I knew it wasn't feasible to do. That's definitely on the agenda. So I had picked my route of kind of hitting all the remaining states. Then the next big decision was what I'm actually going to do when I'm driving through all of these states.
Yeah.
And I recently entered the world of ultra running, basically running distances beyond the marathon. So, whether it's a 50K or a 50 miler or 100K, I'd recently started doing that. And as a result, I'd been spending a lot of time running on trails.
Yeah.
And loving it. Really, really, really loving it. Just really loving the feeling of dirt under my feet again.
Yeah.
And just being out in nature, not having to worry about everyday life, city life. You know, I've always been pretty big cities. And so I wanted to incorporate that into the trip. And so I decided, why not try and run in as many national parks as I could.
Mm-hmm. And you set out to do this by yourself, correct?
Yeah. And right. This was kind of a journey of self-discovery or what have you. I mean, in other words, you know, I wanted to have that alone time where I was able to reflect on just life and also kind of thinking about the journey ahead in terms of, you know, I kind of have just finished law school and I'm entering the legal profession as a lawyer and kind of thinking about how I want to live the rest of my life because, you know, it's really important to lead a very good life.
Yeah.
So I just thought it would be the perfect opportunity to become a faster runner, to see the country, to have that personal space to reflect and just to be, you know, to be humbled by nature. So
yeah,
that's how it all started.
Yeah. So did you make any self-discovery revelations while you were on the trip?
Well, I mean, I think one of the big surprises for me was that I found out that I really value the alone time. I think people would generally say that I'm very social and very, I'm an extrovert, but it was really, really rejuvenating to just be by myself.
Mm.
And that was actually one of the biggest fears I had, just kind of being alone and, oh my God, how am I gonna spend 45 nights out in the wilderness by myself? And it actually was amazing. And
yeah.
I kind of miss it. It was just awesome just to set up my own tent, just do whatever I wanted. And each day, just going wherever I wanted, running wherever I wanted. And yeah, I mean, it was incredible.
Yeah. So I'm imagining that you probably got lost a few times. Is this true?
Yes. This is a little bit embarrassing, but basically in my first major national park, which was Theodore Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota, I got pretty hopelessly lost kind of on a backcountry trail. And I'm really, really glad I went to the ranger station and talked to the rangers first, because my original plan was to take the Achenbach Trail there, which is a 18-mile trail that really, really goes really far backcountry. It's really isolated. I mean, just as kind of context, Teddy Roosevelt National Park is one of the least visited national parks in the system. It's not very popular because it's kind of in the middle of nowhere in North Dakota. But even within Teddy Roosevelt National Park, there's a north unit and a south unit. And the south unit is on the major highway that goes through North Dakota. The north unit, though, is 60 miles on a local road off of that highway. And so I think the ranger said that 90% of visitors to the park go to the south unit and only 10% go to the north unit. So that's kind of the baseline. We're starting with that minimal visitorship on the north and in the north unit. But then even within the park, there are some backcountry trails, and some of these trails are never, the visitors never use them because people go there for the more scenic, easy trails.
Right.
So the Achenbach was way backcountry. It had been, there was a risk of thunderstorms, and the trail had two river crossings. And basically, if there's a thunderstorm and, you know, there could be a flash flood, if you cross the river, it's kind of like a Chris McCandless Into the Wild situation where a flash flood will just raise the river level and you can't cross back. I didn't want to take that risk. So I decided I'm not going to do that. I want to do something easier, something less remote. I don't remember the name of the trail, but it was another backcountry trail.
Yeah.
Took me pretty far back and basically got lost. The thing is, there are a lot of bison in this area of the country. And the bison, when they move around, they push down the grass and they create their own trails.
Mm.
Normally, the human trails are kind of distinguishable because, for you know, the width of the trail is wider or what have you. You can kind of tell when you have a human trail. But because this was such a remote part of the park, every time I got to a post, a signpost, there were six intersecting trails. And only one of them was the actual trail. The other the other five were trails created by bison.
Yeah.
And the worst part of it was the faintest trail was the actual trail. Uh-huh. And the other five trails that were really, you know, that looked really man-made or whatever, those were bison trail. And so I kept, it was like a labyrinth game.
Oh my gosh.
This high prairie, just crisscrossing back and forth. And at one point I thought I'd made it and kind of was on the right track.
Yeah.
And then as I came back up the side of this cliff, I've discovered that I was literally where I'd been an hour ago.
I kind of
panicked. And I knew how to get back out the way I'd come in.
How many miles was that, though?
I mean, it was probably 5 or 6 miles. So, okay. And I had a lot of water still at that point. I had a lot of food, but it was a moderately hot day.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't want to keep circling around there. So I had probably spent 2 hours kind of in the same spot. I mean, or coming back to the same spot. So, and I was, you know, it had taken 90 minutes to get there. So I was 3.5 hours in and I was only a third of the way through the trail. So I thought, okay, well, if I finally get back on the trail, but I'm fully out in the wilderness, how am I going to make it back without running out of water and, you know, getting dehydrated? So pulled out my phone. Turned out I had one bar. And so I went onto Google and typed in, like, you know, the NPS ranger station, and turned out that there was a phone number and they connected me to the visitor center. And at first they tried to redirect me and get me back onto the trail, and it just didn't work. I just couldn't figure out what they were talking about. And frankly, some of the signposts had been knocked down by the bison because they like to use that as a scratching post. So I was in this tall prairie, tall grass. It was just impossible. So I called them again after getting lost again. And I said, you know, I don't know what to do. I think I'm just going to turn around. And then the ranger was like, just stay there. We're going to send someone to help you. And so 15 minutes later, I look out on the horizon and I see this NPS truck, and out pops a ranger. And he's basically like, I can either try and point you back in the right direction or you can hop in. And so I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to hop in.
Yeah.
So I hopped in, and it was kind of crazy because this van or this Jeep had, between the passenger seat and the driver's seat, it had two M16 or, you know, two assault rifles in there. And, you know, it's kind of, I was actually outside. I had actually reached the border of the park. And so the ranger had come from the highway outside to fetch me. I was lost.
What was going on in your head at this point? Like, when you were lost?
To be honest, I wasn't very much panicked about safety, but I was very, very demoralized. This was day 4 or day 5 of the trip. But again, this was my first major national park. This was my first test of, do I have what it takes to be out in the wilderness running alone, and can I be safe about it?
Yeah.
And so I thought, holy, how am I going to do this for another 40 days and not die or, you know, yeah, get into serious trouble. I then came back to the visitor center, and the head ranger created, blazed those trails 30 years ago when he first became a ranger. He blazed them on horseback. I met with him and I had to do like a debriefing, kind of explaining, you know, what went wrong. Yeah. It was more to help me figure out what went wrong for my benefit in the future, so that I wouldn't repeat the same sort of mistakes. He actually also apologized too, because I mean, apparently a lot of people have been getting lost that summer.
Oh, not surprised.
You know, so he also was troubleshooting, trying to figure out where could we be a little bit better, yeah, about maintaining the signposts, or why it is that visitors keep getting lost. Because I actually ended up doing a different trail right after the debrief, and it ended up being amazing. This was not even the most challenging of trails, or, you know, in terms of like navigation. I was expecting to do more difficult stuff later on. So yeah, not a great start, but
yeah,
still an amazing, amazing run. And the second trail that I did, the Cap Rock Coulee Trail,
yeah,
it was just stunning. And I ran into a bison there, which was also an incredible experience, because I had been told by the rangers that if the bison change their behavior, you're too close. And what I'd done was I was running on this Cap Rock Coulee Trail in the Badlands, and I was running and just kind of focused on running and focused on watching my footing. I got over the crest of a hill, and as I was bombing down the other side, all of a sudden I see this brown object move in the corner of my eye. And there in front of me was this massive bull who had been sitting on the dirt. And he saw me and he immediately got onto his on all fours.
Yeah.
And he kind of rotated in position and faced me. And at that point, I freaked out again because I totally was not expecting to see a bison on this trail. And so I immediately put on the brakes, stopped, slowly backed away. And, you know, I'd heard stories about how this summer, I think, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 people have been killed by bison. Too many people try to take selfies with the bison and then they get run over, because bison, I think their top speed is 40 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And they weigh 1,500 pounds. So you don't want to mess with a bison.
Yeah.
Especially a bull. And this one was a bull too. So what ended up happening was I waited and noticed that it wasn't approaching me, or wasn't stamping its feet, or, you know, it wasn't doing anything. So I felt a little bit more comfortable, but it was still standing and staring at me. So I moved a little bit further back. And once I could tell it was kind of in a stable position or what have you, I pulled out my camera and took some photos. And actually, some of the photos are really cool. And Senator Chuck Schumer actually reposted one of my photos on National Bison Day on his Instagram account. So that was pretty cool.
You know, what I'm curious about is, so when you're on these long runs and when you're in the car driving from state to state, like, what are you thinking about? What is going on in your head?
Quite frankly, most of the time, I was just thinking about what I was about to do next. Or how awesome what I had just done was. But really, I was always looking ahead. I was always planning ahead. And quite frankly, this was one of the most exciting challenges I've ever had in my life, because it was a big puzzle, a logistical puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
I felt a little bit like I was in the military, kind of trying to map out a battle plan or a strategy, because I had to figure out lodging, I had to figure out food, I had to figure out nutrition, I had to figure out what equipment I was going to carry each day, because, you know, carrying an extra 5 pounds of gear can make a lot of difference if you're on your feet for 7 hours, or if you're climbing 5,000 vertical feet to the summit of a mountain. So all of those choices matter a lot. And even the little things, like what time I wake up, how much and when I eat my breakfast, when I decide to break camp, and, you know, whether I decide to stop to see something that I hadn't planned to see, but that I drive by and, you know, think, oh, wow, that would be cool to see.
Yeah.
It was a really fun challenge to always be figuring out what to do, because really this was not meant to be a chill, just at my own pace, just kind of spend however much time I needed in each park. I really wanted to hit every state that I hadn't been to. Mm-hmm. And so now I've been to 49 states. Alaska is the only state I haven't been to. Okay. So I really wanted to do that, which meant that logistically I needed to hit the perimeter of the U.S.
Yeah.
And so I knew I was going to drive around 10,000 to 11,000 miles in 45 days. And on top of that, I wanted to run as many trails as I could. It was really, really hard.
You seem, though, like a pretty, like, even-keeled guy. Like, I can't really imagine you panicking or, like, getting so flustered.
Yeah. I try and stay calm, but I'm a worrywart.
Ah.
Maybe that's why I'm good at being a lawyer. Maybe that's why I decided to become a lawyer. But it's weird. I have this kind of risk aversion, but at the same time, I love taking risks. And I'm, like, a calculated risk taker.
Yeah.
So I generally try and avoid risk, but every once in a while, I really want to put myself out there.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to do that. So, yeah. No, I mean, there are some heart-throbbing moments.
Yeah.
And actually, this one's a good story.
Okay.
This is the only moment of my entire trip where I was actually scared for my life. Basically, I had arrived in Joshua Tree National Park, which is kind of in the desert east of L.A., three or four hours east of L.A., I had gotten a campsite at Jumbo Rocks Campground, which is known as one of the best, most beautiful campgrounds in the country. And basically, what makes it so amazing is that there are jumbo rocks everywhere. So if you know about trails and things like that, like, it was just as if you had a cairn, like a pile of rocks that you find on trails, except that each little pebble was the size of a car. In other words, it was just a huge. These massive piles of rocks that looked like these giant cairns. And the campsites were kind of scattered about at the base of these rocks. And you could basically climb up wherever you wanted, if you were able to. Last year, I actually started rock climbing. I'm still really bad, but I got at least comfortable on the wall.
Yeah.
But I'd never done anything outside. And that was my that was my pitfall, because I had this false sense of confidence. I found my campsite. I was at the base of this pile of rocks, and I saw the top rock, and I saw the vista. I could kind of envision the vista from there. And I told myself, I'm going to go up there before sunrise, and then I'm going to take photos of the sunrise from the top.
This is still something I would do too.
Yeah. So I was always looking for really cool vantage points for photos. So I knew that that was going to be something special. So I decided tomorrow morning, I'm going to wake up at 5 a.m. I'm going to climb up there in the dark, and then I'm going to take photos and watch the sunrise second by second, minute by minute. And then I thought to myself, hold on, that actually looks like a pretty challenging set of rocks to climb. If I'm going to climb that for the first time in the dark, that might be a little bit risky. And so it was still before sunset, and I was thinking, okay, I'm going to go up and preview it and just find a route to get to the top. So I immediately start, and it's actually quite easy for kind of at the bottom. The rock's really wide, and the next step, it was easy to get up. But then I got to the second to last rock, and I was kind of on the capstone, or whatever you want to call it. And the sides of that wall or of that rock were really, really steep. And there was just no easy way of getting up there. I was kind of thinking, okay, I guess I could just take the photos from, the second to last rock. And then I thought to myself, that's really stupid. I climbed all the way up here. I got to get to the top.
Yeah.
So then I become really determined. And when I kind of get into that zone, I start to forget about other things.
Uh-huh.
I got into the zone, and I basically, it took a lot of time, but I kept circling around looking for the best way up. I kept trying, I got on and then kind of fumbled around and realized I couldn't get up. And then I dropped back down and found a new spot. I finally was able to get up.
Yeah.
It was quite challenging. Like, I had scraped my chest up against the rock and my arms were all not bruised, but they're all scraped up too.
Yeah.
And I was really proud of myself. I had just conquered this bouldering problem.
Basically. Yeah.
First time on my own, just out in the wilderness. And I took some photos of the sunset. I was really happy, and it was great, and was really excited to know that I was going to come back in the morning and catch the sunrise, because I've loved seeing the sunrises. Yeah. Well, after doing that, I decided it was time to descend, and then I panicked. That was when I panicked, because that was when I realized that I didn't know how I was going to get back down. Because, I don't know, I mean, maybe it's obvious, but it's actually, I found that it's actually very difficult climbing back down.
Yes.
Like, it's harder to climb back down.
Yes.
Than it is to climb up.
And it looks so much worse because you're looking down. Yeah.
So I was probably a good 50 or 60 feet above my campsite, and it was really high up. And the problem was, I basically tried to climb down, and I got down as far as I could, mm-hmm. and I was, you know, kicking my feet out to try and catch the next,
oh my gosh,
you know, hold or whatever.
Yeah.
But there was nothing there. And so the thing is, the second to last rock, was the width of platform was only just slightly wider than the top rock. And so in other words, I could have just dropped down, like let go of my hands and dropped down. But if I rolled, or if I jumped or bounced, yeah, or did anything like that, I would have fallen right off of the ledge and, you know, another 40 feet down to the bottom.
Oh, gosh.
So that was not a risk I wanted to take. Really, probably when I was dangling on the rock and my feet were fumbling or kind of in the air, I probably was only 3 feet from the rock below, or the rock platform below. But I did not want to take that risk, because there was only at most 3 feet, maybe less than that. You know, it was, yeah, really just, I had to have been able to just drop down, mm-hmm, and just stay in that one position.
Mm-hmm.
If I moved even, mm-hmm, a foot backwards, yeah, I would have gone flying off the rocks. And that was not a risk I wanted to take.
Yeah, understandable.
So then I panicked again, because I'm dangling and I'm just stuck. I'm frozen. I'm like Spider-Man, and I'm stuck.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what to do. So I stood there, or I was just frozen there. Then my palms started to get sweaty.
Oh.
My grip was starting to loosen. And so I panicked again.
Yeah.
And so I scrambled back up.
Yeah.
At this point, I was almost on the verge of screaming out to another campsite and asking for help.
Yeah.
You know, because I think it would be possible for a spotter to come and maybe just, like, you know, provide like a human staircase or whatever.
Yeah.
That's all I needed. Just, yeah, like one more step, one more foothold.
Right. Yeah. And was it still light out at this point?
It was dark.
Okay.
It was dark. Yeah. I mean, it was not complete. It wasn't pitch black.
Yeah. But
the sun
had set.
Yeah. So, okay, it was, that made it doubly scary, because I knew that the more time I was spending up here, the less I would be able to see. I had my headlamp because I knew I was going to be up there at, yeah, sunset.
Uh-huh.
But that's also tough, because you only see what you're,
yeah,
directly looking,
yes,
at. And,
yeah,
so it's hard to get that depth perception.
Mm-hmm.
So I really didn't know. I would look down and I would kind of see, oh, that's only, you know, a few feet. But I couldn't know for sure, and I,
yeah,
didn't want to take that risk.
Yeah.
So after letting the hand perspiration kind of evaporate.
Oh my gosh. I'm surprised it did. Mine would probably just
It was so scary.
Yeah.
My heart was pumping. It was,
yeah,
so scary.
Yeah.
It all evaporated. I regained some composure. And then I decided, okay, well, let me try something new. Because what I tried to do was go back down the way I'd come up.
Mm.
And then I thought to myself, well, it doesn't have to be that way. Right, just because it was easier, that was the only route I could find coming up,
yeah,
doesn't mean it's the best route to go back down.
Right.
And again, like, I'm sure that sort of thinking is obvious to an experienced rock climber, but this is my first time outdoors, not on a climbing wall. And so this was like the revelation I had at the top. And I just felt so smart at that point, even though, oh my God, it's, you know, it's so stupid. But so I then did a little like recon, and I butt scooted around the, you know, the perimeter of the rock.
Yeah.
And I found a place where I could kind of butt scoot down a little bit. It was like a decline.
Yeah.
And so I butt scooted to the edge, and I looked down, and it actually, I mean, it was a larger drop to the rock below, but the width, the depth of the rock there was 10 feet.
Yeah.
And so I knew that if I jumped, I might break my leg, you know, I might break a bone or something like that, but I wasn't gonna fall off 40 feet, an additional 40 feet.
Yeah.
So I could jump down, you know, do like a little ninja roll and hopefully survive.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. And then as soon as I got down to that, you know, second to last rock, it was so easy getting back down the rest of the way.
Yeah.
But oh my God, I was almost like jumping for joy when I made that jump and didn't go flying off.
Yeah.
And didn't break my leg.
Oh my gosh. Wait, so what did you think about when you were like going to bed that night? It must have been like a lot of, thank God I survived. Was there any thought of like, okay, I need to do this XYZ in life now? Because you were so like, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I realized then that I kind of needed to be a little bit more aware of what I was doing. You know, I felt like I'd been really good about safety and what have you, but I realized that I had kind of let myself
cross the line that you didn't want to.
Yeah, or just kind of let my guard down. When I was so determined to get to that final rock, get on top of that final rock, that was when I let my guard down. Because up until then, I was very conscious about safety and whatnot. But then all of a sudden, I'm so determined to get to the top that I just forget about all the risks.
Yeah.
The fact that I came out of that without any broken bones lets me reflect on that experience in a very positive way. I found it, I mean, it was quite frankly an awesome, it was thrilling.
Yeah.
It was thrilling, right? Like when you're on the edge of whatever, you know, your comfort zone, that's the greatest kind of
thrill. I know,
thrill.
It's such a rush. Yeah.
Such a rush.
Yeah.
And so I can view that experience as like one of the biggest rushes that I've ever had.
But, that's an important lesson just like in terms of like climbing or anything like that. Coming down is so much harder and a lot more accidents happen on the way down.
Interesting.
But the focus is always going up. Have you seen the movie Meru?
No.
Yeah.
But I need to.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I saw it over the summer and then the directors were in DC last week.
Oh, cool.
And so I went to see them speak. And they were saying how like the whole movie is about like them climbing up to the top but they don't show that much footage of them coming down,
right.
But coming down is actually much more dangerous than going
right.
up. But you know, the average person doesn't really know that. And we're kind of conditioned on go to the summit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what the focus is on. But they were saying how so many more accidents, whether it's hiking or climbing, is always on the way down.
Now that you mention that, I realized that whenever I was in the climbing gym, I always just
lay down. Yeah.
I never climbed down, except when I was on the short wall.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Wow.
And if you think about it,
I had no practice.
Yeah.
Down.
And if you think about it too, it makes sense, right? Because when you're climbing up, like you can see, but when you're coming down, I can't always see where my feet are going,
right?
Sometimes you have to go into the And so,
I'm so stupid. Oh my gosh. I can't. Anyways.
Would you say that your trip overall was more mentally difficult or physically difficult?
Mentally, definitely mentally. Your body is never the limiting factor. It's what's in your head that's the limiting factor. I mean, sure, you need to be in decent shape to do something like what I did. I'm a good athlete. I'm a good runner. I'm, you know, whatever. But I'm not like a top athlete. I'm not naturally gifted or naturally talented.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I put in the hours and I try and train my mind to.
Yeah.
Push through the pain and that kind of thing. So, you know, if you're able to do that, you know, the sky's the limit.
Yeah.
So.
One thing I actually very much admire about your approach to all this is that it's very balanced. I remember we were talking about your trip and I asked about like your training and then you were just very like, you know, some days I just take off a day or a day or two. And it was very unlike other ultra athletes that I know who are super regimented and like kind of become obsessed and, you know,
Yeah, that's, I mean, balance is actually one of the most important things to me. Just being balanced, however, you know, on any sort of spectrum or any sort of dimension. Balance is really important to me, whether it's work-life balance or when you talk about diet. When it comes to training, I do try and find that balance. And I go a little bit by feel. If I know that my body's tired, I'm not going to force myself to run.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take however many days off that I need, whether that's one day or 5 days. And that's another thing I learned. People take to the road for any number of reasons. Mm-hmm. And really, it's your own journey. You do whatever makes you happy or whatever you think is going to be meaningful. Mm-hmm. And who cares about what other people think? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I lived my summer. Mm-hmm. I just did what I wanted to do within the bounds of the law and, you know, kind of social norms.
Yeah.
And it was great. And people are always like, oh, like camping by yourself must have been so boring or so lonely. I was like, no, actually, it's fine. Really fun to just sit by myself and just enjoy the outdoors and to cook a simple meal and then to just sit in my sleeping bag and look at the stars.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think you espouse by that motto that you were talking about, like you do what you want to do within the bounds of law? Do you do that for other areas of your life, you think?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm not going to say I'm a nonconformist or what have you, but I try not to be that person who always just jumps on the bandwagon, mm-hmm. or does what everyone else is doing. I'm trying always to be a little bit unique, be a little bit different.
Well, I think you've done that with this trip. Yeah, yeah, for sure. So for our listeners who don't have the time or the resources to go on an epic adventure like this, if you could single out one national park that you think everyone should visit, which one would you pick?
Realistically, Yellowstone, mm-hmm. National Park is probably the best recommendation for the general visitor. There's just so much in there. Mm-hmm. Yellowstone is so massive that it's larger than the states of Rhode Island and Delaware combined. So it takes a lot of time to even drive the perimeter. I mean, it's like a few hundred miles to drive the perimeter. There's basically, it's called the Grand Loop. It's like a figure eight set of major roads. And Yellowstone has everything. It has the most incredible set of species, like wildlife. It has the Grand Canyon of the Yellowstone and the river. And then there's Yellowstone Lake, which has its own little ecosystem. And then it has the mountains and the forests, and it has everything. The way I kind of viewed it was as kind of our real Jurassic Park. I mean, it was that grand.
Yeah.
And kind of it felt like Jurassic Park because, you know, you're on this grand loop and all these cars with all these tourists are you know, circumnavigating the place. And everywhere you look, it's just so grand and so epic. And you see these ginormous herds of bison, but it is just the best bang for your buck. Mm. You can see everything. It's the scale is epic beyond belief. So that's what I'd recommend to the general person.
Yeah.
But I think if you're fit and you're able to do it, I think the Grand Canyon is incredible. Okay. I did the rim to rim. So I ran from the North Rim down to the Colorado River and then up to the South Rim. And that's about the route that I took was about 24, 25 miles. And I descended 5,000 vertical feet and then ascended 5,000 vertical feet. And I did that in under 7 hours. And everyone has seen the Grand Canyon, but you kind of see the aerial shot or the shot from the rim looking down into the valley or into the canyon. But it's completely different when you are actually at the bottom of the canyon. And yeah. On either side, you have these massive canyon walls that go up several thousand feet. And you just think, holy cow, when I was up on the top of the rim looking down, that just looked like a little crack. Yeah. And I'm in that crack now, and I'm following that crack to the water.
Yeah.
And it's so crooked that, in parts, that you look down towards where you're headed, you know, within 100 feet, the wall comes up again because you have to go around the bend.
Yeah.
But it's just this constant zigzag, and you're just running in there between these narrow canyon walls for 5 hours or whatever, 7 hours.
Yeah.
And it was really, it really kind of gave me a good sense of the scale of our universe or kind of our planet.
Mm.
So that is my real recommendation.
Mm. Okay.
But I don't think everyone would be willing to go all the way down and all the way across.
Yeah.
I mean,
would it take a normal person?
I mean, a lot of the people spend 4 days doing that crossing or at least two nights.
Yeah, and you did it in 7 hours.
Yeah, I did it in 7 hours. But there are people who do a double crossing. They do rim to rim to rim, so they do a round trip. And that's, you know, 40 some miles and 11,000 vertical feet gained in a day. And they do that in, you know, whatever, 15 hours. I mean, Rob Krar, who's the record holder, I think he does the double crossing in 6 hours. He's done the one-way crossing in 2.5 hours.
Oh, my gosh. That's incredible.
It is incredible.
Yeah.
It is incredible to think that. Yeah. And the thing is, when you only go one way, you have to get back to your car on the other side. So I took the Trans Canyon shuttle.
Uh-huh.
It's $80. It's a 240 or 220 mile drive. I mean, it's a 5 hour drive to get back.
Yeah.
Because you have to take the highway all the way out to the eastern edge of the canyon where it's narrow.
Mm.
And then you cross the Navajo Bridge and get back on the, you know, to whatever side you're going to.
Yeah.
And then you have to drive all the way back to the rim.
Yeah.
And so he basically can get from one side of the rim, one rim to the other rim faster than someone in a car.
Oh my gosh.
It's crazy.
Yeah, crazy. Okay, so Wookie sent me this question, which I think is a really good one. I'm going to ask you this, okay? What important truth do you think very few people agree with you on?
Can't believe I forwarded this question.
I'm so
this
glad.
Is a really hard question.
It's a really hard question.
And I don't know if this truth is an important one, but it's definitely something that I believe is the case, but that, you know, people don't think is the case. And it's basically, anyone can become a morning person.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Now, are you speaking from experience?
Yeah, I'm speaking from experience partly. I'm really not a morning person. Everyone thinks I'm a morning person. And I really don't like waking up super early. But the thing is, through various aspects of my life, I've kind of tried to be that person who wakes up early. And I try and do things early in the day when kind of everyone else is still asleep.
Yeah.
I was never a morning person. And when I first started running with November Project up in Boston back in 2012, I just couldn't believe that people were getting up at 5 a.m. or sometimes even 4:30 a.m. to go run up and down stairs, you know, concrete steps in a stadium. And my friend basically persuaded me to go out and give it a go. And I kind of wanted to try and do that kind of intense workout in the stadium.
Mm.
But just the idea of waking up that early was not fun. I mean, you know, I wake up early to do runs before school or before work or what have you. But that means I wake up at 7 and get a run in, or maybe 6:30, but never 5:30 or 5. Or I've actually started showing up to some of the 5:30 a.m. workouts, which means I wake up and I run to the workout so that I wake up at 4:45 and then I'm out the door by 5 and then I get, you know, whatever. So if you have a reason to wake up, you will wake up and you will be that early morning person.
Mm-mm.
And so it's just a matter of having that thing that you want to do, whether it's something you're passionate about or, you know, having that purpose. I mean, in other words, if you have that purpose to wake up and really get out of bed, then it's not a problem. You can be that morning person.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on to my set questions.
Okay.
Yeah, so Wookie, what is a pet peeve of yours?
People being late.
Yeah.
And people being habitually late. It really is annoying. And the worst thing is when someone texts you and says, you know, I'm on my way. And then you later find out that they had just woken up from a nap when they sent that to you.
Yeah.
And that's just really annoying. Like, just tell me the truth. It's okay. I can wait.
Yeah.
But don't say you're 5 minutes away when you're 30 minutes away.
Yeah.
I hate that.
All right. So what is your favorite chore?
Favorite chore? Well, I like doing laundry. I like having clean clothes and I love folding up my socks. It's just a fun, I like matching up the, you know, the different colors and putting it away. And actually one thing I get really stressed about, sometimes I panic, is when I'm doing laundry and I kind of notice or think that I've lost one sock, I start to panic. I say, oh my God, where did I put that sock? And then, you know, I find that it's like stuck inside my shorts.
All right. So what's the first website you check in the morning?
I guess the first website that I see is, you know, are my home pages.
Mm.
And that's Google Calendar and then Todoist, which is my online to-do list.
Mm-hmm.
And then depending on how I feel, I'll either have Slate or the New York Times as the third tab. So really, I'm just checking my calendar and just checking my to-do list just to see a preview of the
day. What's on deck? And so can you tell us a little bit about your morning and evening routines? I know we talked a little bit about your mornings, but if you could provide a little bit more color maybe to...
Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, I'll wake up really early. You know,
What's really early?
Well, so depending on if I'm going to the 6:30 November project, I mean, if I'm going to 6:30, I'll wake up around 5:30 or 5:45. If I'm going to 5:30, I'll wake up at 4:30 or 4:45. Mm. But then the other days, I wake up at 8.
Mm. But you have a really good evening routine, I remember.
I always spend a few minutes writing in my 5-year diary. Basically, it's a small book, probably 3 or 4 inches wide and 5 or 6 inches tall. And each page is a single day, and it's split into 5 rows. And so you see, you know, as you are filling in entries for each day, which really a little, you can only fit 1 full sentence or, you know, 3 short snippets of text. But over the years, you can see what you did 1 year ago, 3 years ago, or 5 years ago, or I guess 4. And it's really, really cool. And it really... What I like about it is that it's a good reminder of what you've done kind of in your life. I think it's really easy, especially if you're like me and you don't have a good memory. Mm. It's really great when you kind of read and you see, oh, 2 years ago, I did that. And all I need to put is just what I did, just a very basic podcast interview with Natalie Kim. Mm-hmm. When I read that 4 years from now, when I'm looking back through my diary, I'll immediately... picture, you know, your apartment. Mm-hmm. Like I'll kind of be able to see the mic and, mm-hmm. you know, all that. Like all of that comes
back.
Yeah, I'm able to retrieve a lot of those memories. And so I love that.
All right. So what is your best resume virtue and your best eulogy virtue for David Brooks, who might be listening?
I guess my resume virtue is that constant quest for efficiency, mm-hmm. or my desire to be efficient. Mm-hmm. I hate wasting energy, wasting time, wasting money. And maybe that's why I love ultra running and I've really fallen in love with it, because it's all about not wasting any excess energy. There's some downsides to that. You can get a little crazy, like neurotic in terms of your quest to save money or save energy or save time or whatever it is. Yeah. But for the most part, what I like about it is that that means I can do more with my life. Mm-hmm. So that's a resume virtue.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, definitely.
So
yeah.
My eulogy virtue would be that I'm a very optimistic person. I'm always someone who makes lemonade out of the lemon juice or sees the glass half full, not half empty.
And the last question, who is someone famous you would want to listen to this podcast episode, Wookie?
That famous someone would be Casey Neistat. This might come as a surprise, but he is kind of one of my biggest role models / heroes. He's a triathlete and a runner, but that's kind of his side hobby. He's a filmmaker. He's a YouTube sensation. And lately he's working on a kind of social media platform called Beam, B-E-M-E. What I admire about Casey is that he is someone who makes the most out of life. He's done a lot of really cool videos where he's just traveling the world and doing ridiculous things, and he's someone who kind of inspires me to keep going for things. I love watching his daily vlogs and I love watching all his videos. And so if you're listening, Casey.
We look forward to hearing from you, Casey. All right. Well, thanks for joining this episode of Personality with guest Wookie Kim. Hope you all have a fantastic week and join us for next week's episode. And as always, let's talk awesome.